This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
You know, you'd think the biggest artificial intelligence news of the year would be a robot finally learning to walk perfectly like a human.
Right. Yeah.
Because we have this collective sci-fi expectation that the future will look, I don't know, exactly like us, just made of chrome.
Yeah, a whole Hollywood aesthetic.
Exactly. But instead, a London startup just became Europe's most valuable new robotics company by taking their flagship humanoid robot and, well, just slapping it on a set of wheels.
Which is so funny because it completely shatters that glossy expectation we all have.
Yeah.
I mean, the market isn't rewarding perfect human mimicry right now. It's rewarding raw, unglamorous utility.
Yeah. And that tension and that gap between what we expect AI to be and how it is actually functioning in the real world. That's the core mission for today's deep dive.
Absolutely.
We are, you know, cutting through the deafening noise of AI hype to examine the hard data on how this technology is actually integrating into the workforce today.
And we also have to navigate this massive geopolitical tug of war that is, well, it's threatening to fracture this entire industry right down the middle.
Yeah, it really is. And to map all this out for you listening today, we are relying heavily on a really comprehensive briefing and commentary provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim. And actually, before we go further, I want to clarify something explicitly for you listening.
Oh, right. The background.
Right. Our source today is a former lawmaker, but the lawyer and the former lawmaker are the exact same person. So for all subsequent mentions today, we're strictly going to refer to him only as lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
Yeah, and having that dual perspective from him, you know, the ground level legal liability combined with high level legislative strategy, it's critical for this because the sources we're looking at today span some pretty wild extremes.
Oh, completely.
I mean, we have an AI proving a mathematical theorem from 1946, a nearly $2 billion pharmaceutical acquisition, and an intense policy battle over international software models.
It's a lot to unpack. We should probably ground this by starting with the macro perspective, right? Like how ordinary people are actually engaging with this technology day to day.
Yeah, that makes the most sense.
So Google and Google DeepMind just released their ATLAS version 1.0 report. And what stands out immediately to me isn't, it's not a survey of opinions.
No, not at all.
It is this massive behavioral map based on over 14.6 million anonymous Gemini conversations.
Which were collected over just a two-week period in April, which is wild.
It's a huge sample size.
Yeah, and they track these interactions across their consumer apps, specialized AI modes, and their APIs.
Which, just to quickly clarify for anyone who might not know, an API is essentially the behind-the-scenes bridge, right? Like, it allows different software applications to talk to the AI engine without the user ever actually seeing a chat box.
Exactly. And by mapping all of this, Google categorized the usage into over 800 jobs and 4,000 distinct tasks across 150 countries.
Okay, so the headline statistic here is that AI usage now touches jobs covering 88.4% of United States employment.
Which sounds insane.
It sounds like absolute total saturation, right? Like, it sounds like the AI is doing literally everything.
Yeah.
But when you actually drill down into the data within any specific job, the AI only touches a median of 21% of a person's tasks.
Right. It's a slice of the job, not the whole thing.
Yeah. It seems like it's operating as a highly specialized tool for very specific pain points rather than, you know, an autonomous replacement.
The data strongly supports that interpretation.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, if you isolate the conversations where users are actively trying to get the AI to automate a task fully end to end, that accounts for less than 10% of all the data.
Wow. Less than 10%.
Yeah. People aren't handing over the keys to their jobs. They are they're using it to unblock themselves on specific stubborn subtasks.
See, I'm going to push back slightly on this idea that it's primarily a coworker tool, though.
Oh, why is that?
Because there's another statistic in the ATLA's report that, for me, completely recontextualizes that 21% figure.
Okay, what's the stat?
A staggering 86% of these 14.6 million conversations occurred entirely outside of formal work hours.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right. So if nearly 90% of our usage is off the clock, are we maybe severely overestimating its current role in the traditional economy and maybe missing its actual primary function as a personal hyper-advanced toy or a tutor?
That is, well, it's a fascinating inversion of the typical enterprise technology narrative.
Yeah, usually it starts at work.
Exactly. Usually high-end tech starts in the corporate office and trickles down to the consumer. Mm. But here, the sheer volume of personal, you know, people planning trips, learning languages, brainstorming hobbies. Hmm. That is what's driving the evolution of the models themselves.
It's all consumer-driven.
Yeah. The tools are adapting to become highly immersive consumer experiences.
Which honestly explains the massive leap we're seeing in multimodal models right now. We're moving way beyond just, you know, typing text into a box and getting a paragraph of text back.
Oh, absolutely. A perfect example of that evolution is the recent release of FLUX3 by Black Forest Labs out of Germany.
Oh, right.
Yeah, what makes FLUX3 fundamentally different from older models is its architecture. Historically, if you wanted an AI to make a video with sound, you'd have one model generate the images, then another model would animate them, and a third model would sort of paste some audio on top.
A very piecemeal.
Right. But FLUX3 is the first model to natively train on image, video, and audio in a single unified structure.
That's incredible.
It understands the relationship between the sound of a roaring engine and the visual of a spinning tire intrinsically from the ground up.
So it can generate up to 20-second videos with perfectly synced sound from just a single prompt. And it's outperforming competitors like Runway Gen 4.5 by, what, 77%? And Lumaray 3.2 by, like, 93%.
Yeah, by huge margins.
And when the technology can spin up a mini movie in seconds, it makes total sense why 86% of usage is just people experimenting for fun.
Right, they're playing with it.
But, you know, that playful consumer side sits in stark contrast to high-stakes professional environments. Because in heavily regulated industries, AI isn't a toy. It is driving billion-dollar acquisitions.
Yeah, the transition from consumer experimentation to enterprise workflow integration, that is where the serious capital is being deployed right now.
Let's talk about LexisNexis.
Yeah, consider LexisNexis in the legal sector.
Yeah.
They just reported the fastest growth in their corporate history, and it was driven entirely by their Lexis Plus Protégé AI tool.
And professionals are paying a massive premium for it, too. I mean, third-party estimates put it at an extra $128 to $494 per month.
Per user, yeah.
Which tells me this isn't just a basic chatbot summarizing PDFs, right?
No, not at all. It's automating over 300 specific legal workflows. And this appetite for deep workflow automation, it isn't isolated to law either.
Right. There was the big pharma deal.
Yeah. The French industrial software giant Dassault Systems is acquiring Aras Global for $1.8 billion in cash, plus another $200 million tied to specific AI performance targets.
Mm-hmm.
And Aras Global builds AI platforms specifically for drug safety and regulatory compliance. They serve half of the world's top 50 pharmaceutical companies.
Law and pharma. I mean, those are two industries where a single mistake can result in massive lawsuits or, you know, much worse.
Exactly.
And this really brings up the core tension that lawyer Kingjin Kim highlighted in his commentary.
Yeah, he made a great point there.
He argues that in the professional sphere, the debate over whether to adopt AI, that debate, is completely over. The defining skill of the modern professional is now the ability to select the right AI tool and meticulously verify its output.
Because the liability doesn't transfer to the machine.
Right.
If Lexis Plus Protégé automates a workflow, but it hallucinates a legal citation that the human lawyer fails to catch, the AI doesn't get disbarred.
The AI doesn't lose its license.
Right. The lawyer's credibility and potentially the entire case is destroyed.
It's essentially the supercar dilemma.
The supercar dilemma.
Yeah. I mean, think about it like this. When you introduce a high-end enterprise AI into your workflow, you are essentially getting behind the wheel of a supercar on a crowded street.
Painfully.
The engine is breathtakingly powerful, and it will get you to your destination faster than anyone else on the road. But if you take your hands off the steering wheel for even a second to trust the autopilot and you crash into oncoming traffic, you can't blame the engine for being too fast.
No, you can't.
The fault lies entirely with the driver who decided to stop steering.
That's a great way to put it. The immense power of the tool actually magnifies the operator's liability rather than reducing it.
Exactly.
Which creates an incredible bottleneck. We have systems capable of doing the heavy lifting, but human verification is slowing the entire process down.
Right. So the inevitable next question is, how close are these systems to reaching a level of elite reasoning where that human verification burden actually shrinks?
Right.
Like, are we approaching a point where the machine's logic is as airtight as a human expert's?
Well, we recently crossed a threshold in mathematical reasoning that is, honestly, it's causing generational academic talent to leave traditional institutions and join AI labs.
The news out of Philly, right?
Yeah, at the International Congress of Mathematicians in Philadelphia, it was announced that Jacob Summerman, who is a 2026 Fields Medalist, is joining OpenAI to research AI safety.
And for context, the Fields Medal is essentially the Nobel Prize of mathematics, right? It's awarded every 4 years to someone under 40.
Exactly.
I know Hong Wang also won this year, becoming only the third woman in 90 years to win for solving the needle problem.
Yeah, an incredible achievement.
But seeing a laureate like Simerman pack up and move to an AI company, I mean, that is a massive signal about the caliber of work happening inside those labs.
It really is. And to understand why elite mathematicians are flocking to these models, you have to look at the difference between a standard chatbot and a true reasoning model.
Okay, break that down for us.
So a chatbot is fundamentally designed to predict the next most likely word in a sentence. It basically guesses its way to an answer.
Right.
But a reasoning model works through formal logic. It tests hypotheses, it backtracks when it hits a dead end, and it generates a verifiable chain of thought.
Which explains the huge breakthrough from May, where OpenAI's reasoning model tackled a problem proposed by Paul Erders way back in 1946.
Yeah, the planar unit distance conjecture.
Right, and this had been unsolved for 80 years.
And the AI didn't just guess the answer, it found the counterexample and generated a mathematical proof that humans could actually verify.
It's wild. Simerman, along with fellow Fields medalist Tim Gowers, they actually co-authored the 19-page paper verifying the machine's proof.
Right. The machine didn't just assist them. It generated the core intellectual breakthrough. It is now operating as a peer.
Taking that level of elite, verifiable reasoning, I mean, an intelligence capable of solving an 80-year-old math problem and putting it into a physical body is obviously the next frontier.
Oh, absolutely.
But translating digital logic into physical movement introduces a whole new set of engineering bottlenecks, which brings us all the way back to the robot on wheels from the intro.
Right. Humanoid, the London-based startup.
Yes.
They recently became Europe's first pure humanoid robot unicorn, hitting a $1.35 billion valuation after a massive Series A funding round of $152 million.
And they achieved this in just 2 years.
Yeah, it's moving incredibly fast.
And their flagship robot, the HMND-01, it abandons the bipedal design entirely.
Because it just makes sense.
Exactly. If you think about the sheer amount of computing power and battery life, a bipedal robot wastes just trying to balance on two legs, adjusting micromotors thousands of times a minute just to not fall over, it's incredibly inefficient.
It's a huge drain on resources.
But by putting the robot on a sturdy base with wheels, 100% of the AI's processing power can be dedicated to spatial awareness, manipulating objects with its hands, and actually doing the job it was hired to do.
It's just the ultimate pragmatic design choice. And industrial giants are heavily validating this approach.
Yeah, the manufacturing numbers are crazy.
Bosch is stepping in to manufacture up to 100,000 units of the HMND-01.
Wow.
And Schaeffler, a massive industrial supplier, has placed an order for 1,000 units, and they even signed on as an investor.
They clearly don't care if the robot can walk upstairs like a human.
Not at all. They care if it can navigate a warehouse floor and assemble parts without failing.
The wheels are actually the perfect metaphor for AI's current trajectory overall.
How do you mean?
Just like that physical robot doesn't need to perfectly mimic human legs to be indispensable on a factory floor, enterprise AI doesn't need to perfectly replicate human consciousness to be incredibly useful in our daily workflows.
Right.
It just needs the digital equivalent of wheels to get the job done efficiently.
Yeah, I think we get so caught up in the philosophical debate about artificial general intelligence that we overlook the immediate massive economic value of these specialized, highly capable systems.
Exactly. So we have these foundational models proving elite math theorems, automating high-stakes legal workflows, and driving robots on factory floors. But all of this relies on the underlying software models.
Right, the core architecture.
And that brings us to a massive geopolitical chokehold, like who actually gets to control access to the architecture of these models.
This is escalating into one of the most intense regulatory clashes of the decade, honestly.
Yeah.
In the United States, we are watching a deep fracture between startup culture and big tech over how AI should be controlled.
And looking at this strictly through the lens of market dynamics and policy, without taking any sides in this heavily politicized environment, you have a newly formed group called the Little Tech Association.
Right.
This represents about 200 influential startups, including Y Combinator and Proton, and they recently sent a formal letter to the Trump administration, urging them not to ban access to Chinese open-weight AI models.
And just to clarify here, an open-weight model means the core recipe, the mathematical weights that dictate how the AI makes decisions, that is made publicly available.
Right, so anyone can use it.
Exactly. Anyone can download it, run it on their own servers, and tweak it without paying a massive tech company for access.
And lawyer Kingjin Kim's commentary really breaks down the stark reality of this debate for the startup ecosystem.
It's an existential issue for them.
Exactly. For them, open access isn't a philosophical stance. It's literally a matter of financial survival. Relying on cheap, capable, open-weight models keeps their operating costs manageable.
Right.
If access to those models is banned, they are basically forced to buy access from a localized monopoly of a few massive American tech companies.
But, you know, those massive tech companies have a very different and a very serious counter-argument centered on national security and the protection of intellectual property.
Yeah, companies like Anthropic are advocating for strict digital borders.
And their concerns aren't theoretical at all. The White House recently flagged an incident involving a Chinese AI company called Moonshot.
The distillation issue.
Exactly. The allegation is that Moonshot's Kimi K3 model engaged in something called distillation, which is essentially taking Anthropic's highly expensive proprietary Fable model and using it to train their own system.
Right. It's the AI equivalent of having a genius student take a test and then letting a smaller model just copy all of their homework without putting in the billions of dollars of initial research.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So big tech is arguing that without strict borders and bans, their intellectual property is being systematically strip-mined by foreign competitors.
But China is aggressively moving to establish its own borders in response to this, right?
Oh, very aggressively. The Chinese Commerce Ministry is currently weighing sweeping export controls that would cover not just AI weights and training data, but core chip designs as well.
See, if China restricts the export of those fundamental chip blueprints, that doesn't just impact software developers. That threatens to fracture the entire physical hardware supply chain.
It absolutely does.
Because global manufacturers like TSMC or Qualcomm rely on those designs to physically print the chips for Chinese tech giants like Huawei, Alibaba, or ByteDance.
Right. It forces a total decoupling of the industry. And the proposed controls would also block Chinese AI startups from being acquired by overseas buyers.
Wow.
Yeah, China's moving to completely lock down its AI ecosystem, treating its models, data, and hardware blueprints as heavily guarded national assets.
Hmm. And we are seeing the immediate fallout of this isolationism in the market right now. Today marks a significant deadline in the Chinese ecosystem.
The DeepSeek migration.
Yes, DeepSeek, which is one of their leading AI labs, is shutting down its old API portals for its chat and reasoning models. They are forcing all developers to migrate to their new architecture,
which includes V4 Flash and this massive new model called V4 Pro.
Wait.
And V4 Pro is a 1.6 trillion parameter model.
1.6 trillion.
Yeah. And just to put that into perspective, parameters are kind of like the digital synapses in the AI's brain.
Okay.
So a model with 1.6 trillion parameters operates at a scale of complexity and reasoning that requires just an unfathomable amount of computing power to train and run.
It's a huge leap.
It's a massive leap in capability. And they are basically corralling their users into this new walled-off ecosystem.
Which raises a really heavy question about the future of this technology for everyone listening. Because, you know, for the last decade, AI development felt inherently global.
It did, yeah. Very collaborative.
It was this open internet era where research papers were shared across borders and breakthroughs really benefited everyone. But looking at these export controls, the distillation allegations, and the lobbying for bans, I mean, are we watching the permanent militarization of AI?
It certainly feels like it.
Are foundational models going to be locked behind heavily guarded digital borders, treated no differently than classified weapon systems?
Well, synthesizing everything we've looked at today, the momentum is aggressively shifting toward fragmentation.
Yeah.
I mean, we started by looking at Google's ATLAS report, which showed AI integrating globally as a highly specialized everyday tool.
Right.
We saw the high-stakes reality of professional liability through lawyer Kingjin Kim's analysis of systems like LexisNexis.
Yeah.
We examined the breathtaking advancements in verifiable logic with the Fields medalists at OpenAI. And then the pragmatic physical embodiment with the wheeled humanoid robots.
But all of that incredible borderless innovation is now crashing straight into geopolitical reality. The regulatory walls are going up everywhere.
They are.
And for you listening, whether you are an individual professional trying to figure out which workflows you can safely automate, or maybe a startup founder trying to manage compute costs using open source models, these regulatory tectonic shifts are going to hit your bottom line.
Unavoidably.
The underlying infrastructure of the economy is being partitioned, and the rules of the game are being rewritten while we are all actively trying to play it.
Yeah, the foundational layer of tomorrow's technology is being divided into distinct national silos today.
Which brings us back to that initial idea, really. We all expected a clean, universal light bulb moment for artificial intelligence, but instead, the light is fracturing.
Yeah.
And that leaves us with a final thought to consider as we watch these digital borders harden. If global AI development truly fractures due to these export controls and strict intellectual property laws, will we eventually see completely different flavors of artificial reasoning?
Wow. That is a profound implication.
Right. Could an AI model trained under strict U.S. intellectual property laws learn to process logic, weigh evidence, and solve problems in a fundamentally different way than a 1.6 trillion parameter model trained securely behind China's export-controlled walls?
It makes you wonder.
If the digital brains are separated for long enough, do the two systems eventually stop seeing the exact same reality altogether? Something to think about as you navigate this rapidly shifting landscape. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll be back next time to keep unpacking it all.
This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
For more from the same network, follow China AI, Robotics and Semiconductor Briefing on Apple Podcasts.